Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back for another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are part informers, part entertainers. Jim considers himself an engineer. I consider myself a stand-up comedian who went into the wrong industry, but we talk a lot about nuclear weapons, their effects, and you know, the countries that have them and stuff like that.
Hey, Adam, speaking of comedy, you consider yourself an engineer. I only consider one because you can see the little thing on my wall behind me. I have a little certificate that says that from a really nice school up in New York.
Yeah, RPI. Some little technical school I've vaguely heard of. But, you know, and so, you know, Curtis isn't actually with us today. He's off doing some gallivanting and some carrying on.
He's traveling. He's having a good time.
Yeah, yeah. But it leaves you and me here to discuss a topic that is sort of near and dear to both our hearts, and that's, of course, weapons effects. Right. And, you know, one of the things that I find so interesting about it is just how little people actually understand weapons effects. And of course it's, you know, it's understandable because people don't sit around and they've got kids to raise and jobs and all the things that keep us busy in life. And so they don't sit around and read books about, you know, they're not reading Gladstone and Dolan, and they're not reading Bridgman, and they're not thinking, you know, all day, every day about how do nuclear weapons, effects propagate, and are there misnomers? And that's just not people's daily concern. So I thought you and I
What do they do with their time if you're not thinking about these things, Adam?
Well, I'm sure they're cooking and cleaning and doing laundry and, you know, working in an office or driving a school bus or a truck or whatever, you know, folks may be doing, you know, farming. I love farming. I don't get to do it. I still grow my garden. I don't farm anymore, though. But, you know, so let's take some time and let's sort of dispel. And, you know, I participated in a war game about a month or so ago. And a lot of the participants who were, you know, sort of fairly senior people, they really didn't understand much about weapons effects. And they were people in the security world, in the national security world. And I was, you know, I guess I wasn't surprised, but because this sort of wasn't their niche area. But I thought maybe for listeners and hopefully for a broader audience, if we talk about, you know, the key effects of nuclear weapons, and then we talk about sort of some of the myths and misnomers, that might be kind of informative. So rather than talking about a foreign affairs article or something else, I thought you and I could just have a discussion about weapons effects. So with that in mind, why don't you sort of kick us off by, you know, giving the listeners the main effects of a nuclear detonation?
Well, thanks, Adam. I certainly will. And it is something I think about quite often because there's a lot of misunderstandings that occur related to nuclear weapons and science in general. People just don't understand a lot of things for a variety of reasons. When you think about it from a nuclear weapons standpoint, I like to frame the argument whatever you want to call it, that we're going to have by starting out by saying, understood, nuclear weapons can be devastating. So we're not saying that nothing can happen when a nuclear bomb goes off. We're not saying that. And we're not. And in fact, their deterrent factor is the fact that they can create great amounts of damage and cause death. So we're not saying that either. But I will also say that a lot of the secrecy around the program, and you want to call it fatalism, people are afraid, fear brings us around. And then, of course, Hollywood and even some of our public officials will say crazy things like make a claim that, oh, we have enough nuclear weapons to destroy the world X times over, et cetera. All these things add to this misunderstanding about nuclear weapons. And so I agree with you, Adam. I think it's a good topic to talk about. And I think we need to have an informed public who understands these things as we battle with the concepts of national security, because national security involves the development, maintenance, and potential use to use in not just in terms of having, but actual employment of nuclear weapons as part of the strategy. If we don't, then we will not have a deterrent. And we're not the only ones with them. So we've got to understand those. So I just want to lay that out as a starting point, because I think the fear that people have, and of course all these other things, really play into it. So let me start out with one of my favorites. There's a lot of things, and it you know, as I've looked to it, but I think one of the biggest and most egregious things that people think about in terms of nuclear weapons, they go, well, if we have a nuclear war, we're going to destroy the entire Earth or wipe out humanity. I think that's probably the biggest misbelief. Now, understand, nuclear weapons create a lot of effects. They do a lot of things because they are nuclear weapons, and they're a lot of energy in a very small package. That's really the nuclear magic. I mean, I don't think of it as magic. I think it's science. I think it's great. But one of the things I think people do is they put it in this magic category as though it's lots of things that no one understands. And it's not. We understand it's blast, which, by the way, conventional weapons have blast. Your firecrackers that you probably played with on the 4th of July, blast. Overpressure, smaller from a firecracker, much larger from a conventional weapon. And nuclear weapons can make larger blasts, and therefore blast, overpressure, and shock, which are the three main things that both kinds of weapons have, conventional or nuclear.
So when you mention blast and overpressure and you mention firecrackers, so we go to my friend Frank's house. He's got a farm up north of town. And so we'll go there and we'll have, these, you know, a quarter stick or an eighth of a stick, and we'll put, you know, we'll light it, and then we'll put like a large trash can on it. Mm-hmm. And then depending whether we're using an eighth or a quarter, you know, that trash can, because of overpressure, that sucker will jump up, because the pressure wants to escape. The best way for it to escape is out the bottom. And so it pushes the trash can up into the air. And
that's a good example.
We get a great amount of joy, and it's so cool and all that. But, you know, the other thing is, if the pressure can escape, then, you know, this year we didn't have it. I said, Frank, aren't we going to, you know, start blowing up the trash can? And he says, well, the last year when we blew up the trash can, we had too much explosives in, you know, underneath it, because we set it upside down and it blew the trash can apart. So when the pressure doesn't have, you know, anywhere to go, it'll destroy things. And so that's where, you know, blast and overpressure have the damage to, you know, buildings and other things, is because they don't have a ready outlet. And so they cause damage.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just sort of a, you know, keeping with your 4th of July analogy, that's kind of a 4th of July analogy. And so, you know, nuclear weapons like firecrackers, they produce blast and they produce overpressure. And if that overpressure can escape, then you get no damage. But if you put things around it that, you know, are in that area where the overpressure is high, it'll knock down trees, it'll knock down buildings, which, you know, is for most nuclear weapons about 60%-ish of the effect of a nuclear weapon is caused from blast and overpressure. So it's, whereas most people think, oh, it's all the everything becomes irradiated. Yeah. And that's why they're so bad. And it's like, no, that's actually not where most of the effect comes from. It's blast and overpressure.
Yes, and that definitely is the answer on the ground. When you get up way up in the atmosphere, there's nothing to push against, like you said about the can. And so therefore, you have more of these other effects, but then they're further away from people. So, you know, you've got to look at both sides. So it gets a little complicated, so we'll settle that down. But that's a great example. You get a blast, overpressure, and the shock, of course, is a thing that breaks things, okay? And then Then you have the thermal energy, that comes off the nuclear weapon. And it, by the way, and we look at Nagasaki and Hiroshima, it was the number one cause of death from the nuclear weapons that were employed in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, was the thermal energy, because it made things hot, it burned them, they caught fire, and these detonations were, of course, occurred off, you know, higher above the ground. And so because of that, the thermal energy was the main piece. Then there's electromagnetic. I'm starting to get into my 3-hour lecture mode here, Adam.
Before you get into that, you brought up Hiroshima, and this is really a great example. So that weapon, which was about 15 kilotons, mm-hmm. was detonated at about 1,400 feet.
Yeah, well, more or less.
For the fallout free height, it's about a little more than, you know, half that. So that was actually detonated quite high. And so it didn't maximize effects. But what it did go ahead, Jim.
It did maximize the aerial effects, like the blast and the overpressure. So you got more blast and overpressure and thermal coverage, but it didn't cause the radiation damage that, because the radiation effects were lowered, because if we did have to invade later on, we knew that within about 30 hours, we could have invaded without any radioactive problems. But go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so the main thing I was going to say was that most people don't realize that it wasn't truly the effect of the weapon that caused the devastation in Hiroshima. It was the fact that buildings were made out of wood and paper. Mm-hmm. And so within about 1,000 meters or so of ground zero, there were fires that got started. And then those fires, so that immediate effect was about 1,000 meters or so. And then then those fires, because fires generate wind.
Just like the Dresden bombings.
Exactly. And then they create a firestorm, and then that wind pushed the fire out. And so the 4-mile radius that was the burn area was largely created from the wind that was created by the fire, and not necessarily the direct impact of the actual detonation itself, which is an important thing that most people don't realize.
A lot of secondary effects. Yeah. So I agree with you. That's another good example. I'm glad we're having this dialogue for our audience. And then the next piece of this is that we also have electromagnetic, which is, you know, electromagnetic, and primarily that electromagnetic signal comes from a high altitude detonation. Not going to get into details, just throwing it out there so we're complete. And then the last of my list is radiation, primarily in the form of neutrons and gamma radiation, which occurs fairly locally to the blast. In fact, the thermal radiation goes many, many times further, because thermal energy, we're glad for this, because otherwise we'd be really cold here in Ohio instead of really hot, because that thermal energy from that big fusion generator in the sky wouldn't make it down to us through the atmosphere. But the thermal energy does. And also the atmosphere blocks the gammas and the protons and electrons in the upper atmosphere. And that's also good for the atmosphere, because the atmosphere absorbs those radiations. Otherwise, we'd be all dead from that big fusion generator in the sky irradiating us all the time. Okay, so BOSTERD, Bostered or Bostered, if you want to. That's Wally Clark III. He's one of our listeners and one of my good friends, a scientist out in New Mexico. So he came up with that very good acronym to understand him. Okay, now, that just lays out the foundation. So the real question is,
remind everybody. Blast,
overpressure, and shock. They're the common ones with other conventional weapons. Thermal, electromagnetic, and radiation. Oh, D, and dust. So dust, we put at the end to not only complete the acronym, but there's the way the detonation occurs, especially when it's near the ground, can pulverize the ground, cause dust that can be radioactive, and can be part of the fallout, which is a separate piece here. And again, not going into that in detail, but it could create worldwide fallout. I get that. We'll get to that in a second. So let me go back to answering your initial question, Adam, do I still get my 3-hour lecture on this podcast, or do I go quicker? Okay. Well, look, there's a popular notion that a full-scale nuclear war means the end of the world, either physically blowing the planet apart or causing human extinction. But in reality, a large-scale nuclear conflict would be catastrophically destructive. Everyone set off nuclear weapons. I'm not going to say that. And I don't want to say, though, that will annihilate human life. In fact, and again, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, I know you say Hiroshima, we're doing this back and forth. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, just my way of saying it, is that people survived at ground zero. There were people there are people that survived, especially in shelters and such, but even some people that were outdoors during the event still survived. So all of humans aren't going to be killed. In fact, studies indicate that some of the in a massive nuclear exchange, we'll have we won't lose it. We'll have pockets of survivors, especially in the southern hemisphere. One, because we don't really have any nuclear states in the southern hemisphere, and it's the trade winds that carry some of the radioactive material that may would cause some death. But if you combine all the nuclear weapons we have, all of them together, and detonate them all at the exact same time, it's not even 1/1000th of the energy required to even cause any kind of disruption of the actual crust or surface of the Earth. So blowing it up thousands of times is just a silly example of how far off this becomes. And we know this because we've studied using nuclear weapons in an attempt to break up asteroids as a planetary defense, and they'd be terrible at doing this because when you blow up a nuclear weapon on a surface, the energy goes up into the air. It doesn't break the thing in half or whatever else is shown in the movies. And so it's a totally impossible scenario. Furthermore, the radiation that's caused by the nuclear weapons, even if they are all detonated on the ground and not in the air, to maximize blast and overpressure, but to maximize radioactive fallout, that fallout begins to decay rapidly. And within about 30 hours, most of the places near ground zero are crossable, if not habitable. And we've seen that, again, in these detonations that are real time, that have really happened. So are we going to destroy the entire planet? No. Are we going to change? And this is, I think, the piece, and I'm going to pass it back to Adam here. It's not about the strategy of an existential threat against all of humanity. It's an existential threat against our way of life, which is different that we have to think about in terms of a nuclear exchange. And you have something to say about that, Adam? I mean, that's sort of the idea, right? People think it's all about all of people, but all of people will not, a full nuclear exchange, not going to cause everyone to die, but rather we could change our way of life. Someone could invade, someone could do something else. It's all those other things, those secondary things that may happen that are the existential threat once, we're crippled by some fashion.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's important for people to understand that we're generally not trying, when we weaponeer nuclear weapons, we are generally trying to destroy a target. And when you just try to destroy that target, you generally are going to have it, it's going to be an airburst. Yeah. And so airbursts are going to reduce the amount of, of prompt and residual radiation. And that's what I think people are so scared of, is radiation. And the reality is that, that's something that by the nature of how we weaponeer, that it's already minimized because we're not putting weapons on the ground, because weapons on the ground are much less efficient than weapons in the air. Because it goes back to my original point, which was, hey, blast and overpressure and shock, that's what does most of the damage, and you got to put them in the air to maximize that. And then, so that's one of the sort of goes back to your point about we're not going to destroy, human civilization. And then there's a second part, and that is, as we've gotten more accurate with nuclear weapons, our yields have gone down dramatically. That's why, you know, with the B83 versus the B61 Mod 13, we're going from a megaton weapon to one that is much smaller, but we're still going to be able to, you know, do bunker busting because, you know, we're going to be much more accurate. We're going to be able to, you know, penetrate. We're going to be able to. And so the fact that our yields, Russia's yields, China's yields, they've all gone way down. So that means there's going to be a lot less, you know, prompt and residual radiation to begin with. And then, oh, by the way, we're probably going to put almost, you know, most of them in, you know, they're going to be airburst. And so this idea that we're going to have this completely irradiated atmosphere and all the earth is going to be spoiled, and it's just not how nuclear war would actually take place.
Yeah. There's another thing that also comes up in these explanations, and they try to claim it's science. And I just want to dispel this as well, is they say, well, if you take the size of the nuclear weapon, about, you know, 20 kilotons in Hiroshima, however you want to say it, Adam. If you take the size of that bomb, you take the number of people died from that incident, and then you say the total kilotonnage of nuclear weapons that we had at one time, us in Russia, if you take that total kilotonnage, you would then kill everyone. You have now the ability to kill everyone from that. It's sort of like the fentanyl argument, right? There's enough fentanyl in the United States to kill everyone, but everyone has to take it, okay? Yeah. And so the same thing happens in some of these arguments that are just absolutely silly. So what they're saying is, if you took all the weapons and you detonated them over the population and all the population stood in a corner, all cowered together in one tight spot, it would kill them all. Well, that's silliness also. That's not where we live. It's not the planet, and it's not the plans. In fact, both us, we in Russia, we can't target everyone all at one time. So it's sort of a misconception. And then there's one other piece that people do with the same set of data. They say, well, if you had a 20 kiloton weapon, you're going to kill this many people. So if I have a 2,000 kiloton or 2 megaton weapon, then I kill 1,000 times more people. And this goes back to Adam's argument. It's a nonlinear problem. If I make a larger weapon, 1,000 times larger, I only get a boost of about a 60 to 80% increase in the amount of damage I can do, because that explosive energy is not going into killing people. It's flying off into the atmosphere and doing other things that don't really work that way. Now, if I had, you know, 1,020 kiloton weapons, and I put them all spread out evenly over some area, yeah, I get that argument. But that's a silly argument when you think about targeting and weaponeering, as Adam said earlier. It doesn't happen. So these kind of arguments get really lost in the real science behind how explosions happen. It's like saying one grenade in you know, my office right now would kill a total of one person, because I'm the only person in my office. But if we threw 1,000 people in my room, I guess grenades can kill 1,000 people, right? And that's just a silly argument. If you spread us around and spread, you know, stuck people on the ceiling and, you know, stuck their faces through the windows or whatever. I mean, it's just a silly, unserious argument. So we need to look at weapons from a serious standpoint and look at what they really do, which is what they do is they deter the use of other nuclear weapons so that we don't have to employ them. And if we do employ them, there is a survivability if we take the appropriate precautions. And I believe that, and to me, that's the biggest risk of not informing the public, as we're doing right now. And what every single person that's listening to this podcast should go out and say, listen to this podcast, because you need to be informed that we need to do protection, but also we need to have these weapons in order to protect ourselves.
All right. Yeah.
Off my soapbox.
Well, now let's turn to, you know, let's turn to tactical nuclear weapons, lower yield. Yep. So, you know, the United States deploys, so deploy versus employ. So the United States deploys up fewer than 200 in Europe, and then it's got a small number of low yield SLBMs that are on submarines. And whereas the Russians and the Chinese, the Russians have, we think, at least 2,000 of these, what I call tactical. And tactical means their range is short and or limited, and their yields tend to be smaller. So whereas, you know, you might have ICBMs, you know, Russia, China, the U.S., that range from 150 kilotons to, you know, half a megaton-ish. Those would be, their range is strategic. They can go at least 5,500 kilometers, and then they have larger yields. So the all these tactical nuclear weapons, lower yields, and the yields can be 100 tons. So if you think about, like, you know, the largest conventional weapons, like a GBU-43, that's an 11-ton weapon. So if you had what would be an ultra-low yield nuclear weapon that the Russians have, that would be, let's say, 100 tons. That's 10 times larger than the large. And, oh, by the way, it's quite small, yep, actually, for a nuclear weapon. Whereas, you know, a GBU-43, you need a pallet and a, you know, a cargo aircraft to drop it. You know, you can drop a ultra-low yield, you know, you can put it in a backpack. As I think at one point in your career, you did that, maybe, or is an artillery shell. And so you can get these yields that are still 10 times bigger than the largest conventional, but yet by nuclear standards, they're tiny. And those are ones that the Russians and the Chinese are building, because they don't want to have a strategic nuclear exchange with the U.S. because that's one where they suffer greatly, we suffer greatly. Everybody loses, even if you can win. You know, it's sort of, you can have a Pyrrhic victory, but, you know, the idea is you lose. Well, they've said, hey, we want to fight. If we're going to use nuclear weapons, we want it in a theater, you know, a theater war. And we think we can beat the Americans in that one because we've got a lot of variety and numbers that they don't have. But one of the things that people don't understand about these types of weapons is that the effects that you were talking about earlier, whereas, you know, the blast and overpressure of a 400 kiloton weapon, the blast radius, that the damaging blast radius might be a mile and a half. The blast radius of a 10 kiloton weapon, and right, that's a big one on something small, or might be 1,000 meters. Or if it's a 100-ton ultra-low yield, that's only going to be a couple hundred yards. And so these things are eminently usable. Maybe give us a little more about that, Jim.
Yeah, so first of all, just to start out or pick up where I left off initially, is that every nuclear weapon, no matter what size it is, produces all these effects.
Sure.
Okay, yeah. So it's not like you don't get thermal energy unless you hit a certain level. That is because of the nuclear process. And the other piece of this is that nuclear weapons are valuable because they do have a lot of energy in a small, lightweight, whatever you want to call it, a smaller package. I always knee-jerk against this, and I know Adam and I think we said this on the podcast once before. You know, I understand your definition, and I appreciate you defining tactical nuclear weapons. I think every nuclear weapon is a political weapon, so it automatically becomes strategic. We can debate that maybe at another time, but they're all nuclear weapons. They all produce these same effects. Now, I, though, also agree that when you make a smaller nuclear weapon, first of all, making small nuclear weapons, unless you're just creating a real inefficient bomb and you're wasting all your uranium or plutonium or whatever you're using for it, if it's inefficient and therefore it's low, then it's sort of a waste of your material. So to make an efficient small weapon requires a lot of smart design. And I'm not going to go into design on this podcast. I don't need anyone showing up at my door asking me for credentials. But when you talk about a small weapon, it's hard to make a small weapon. And that's the first piece. The second piece is, though, that that not everything is scaled. So you get a small weapon, but you know, gammas fly the same distance, whether there's one of them or a thousand of them. The thermal energy flies the same distance through the atmosphere, whether it's a low power or high power. The difference is what the effect may be. A high power of thermal energy will cause something to burst into flames, where a low power thermal energy at the same distance might give you a sunburn or blind you or give you a flash blindness nearby. And so these become more operable and less devastating from a nuclear weapon usage standpoint. And, you know, the amount of radiation you produce, and we'll talk about the small your definition of tactical nuclear weapons, more than likely used as a ground burst nuclear weapon against a ground target or maybe an aerial target slightly above the ground to take out troops in the open or something like that. That blast and that radiation that you pick up from there, the radiation you get is based upon so many tons of pickup of dirt. And you don't pick up much dirt in a tactical nuclear weapon. You know, you don't make a big crater. You know, for those that want to look at it, you know, look out at the craters that were made in at the Nevada test site. You know, these are large amounts of dirt, and that dirt gets lofted in the air. And that's what is the fallout, not the weapon itself. Unless, of course, you make a very, very inefficient bomb and you decide to waste all your uranium on it, which is sort of be a crazy thing to do. The only thing, you know, I can't see a rationale for a country doing that. It would make no sense. So from that standpoint, those effects, again, are very doable. The only concern I have from a tactical nuclear weapons standpoint is the potential for escalation, because once the genie's out of the bottle, then you got to ask what's going to happen in our battlefield. What's the policy? How do you bring that down? And that to me is an issue, but it should be written into our policy. I'm not saying we run scared from it, but we use that as an advantage to say, if you want to open the bottle and you want to start, you know, tossing nuclear weapons around as a tactical force, how are you going to control that from becoming your existential threat? And, you know, that's for the policymakers. But from an effects standpoint, it's, you know, it's minor. You can make these weapons very, very low energy. You can make them. You can also reduce some of the effects through design, and I won't go into detail. But because these are smaller nuclear weapons, they have a smaller radiation load. They have a smaller package. They have a lot less of the things that we worry about with larger nuclear weapons in their secondary effects as well. You know, like secondary fires, et cetera.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, unfortunately, I mean, we could talk about this for hours, but
yeah,
our time is
four more hours of lecture.
I know our time is unfortunately up. So, what's that one thing that you still want people to know before we have to, you know, end this podcast?
Well, I think somewhere along the line we do need to talk about the because I'm sure someone's going to say, well, we're not blowing up the planet. Okay, we get it. You're not going to break the planet in half with our nuclear weapons. But what they're talking about, because this is the other myth that I didn't get to, is that the world is going to be uninhabitable for centuries because of the nuclear wasteland caused by the fallout. You know, I always hear this myth. Well, once you make the uranium radioactive, it's radioactive for billions of years, so we're not going to live there. Well, I hate to tell you this, folks. There are radioisotopes on this planet now that have billions of year half-lives. And guess what? We're all alive, okay? So that whole piece there, we ought to talk about that piece. I do have to – wait, no, I have to add one more. I know you gave me one, Adam. I'm going to give you one more, okay? Well, it's because I work a lot with the national labs, and it's very important. A lot of people say we don't need nuclear weapons because they're, quote, unsafe. Okay, and I'm just going to say the amount of work that the United States does, and even I would say our adversaries, I haven't seen too many accidental detonations from other nuclear weapons. They are not unsafe. In fact, it takes a lot of work and a lot of technology and a lot of accuracy to make them work. And so because of that, they are inherently safer than conventional weapons. Drop a stick of TNT that's been sitting around in a cold, damp environment for a couple years and, you know, hope it doesn't go off. It's not happening with a weapon because of the design and because of the requirements for that. So there you go. So I'm sorry, I ran you over time, Adam, but I want to make sure those two are hit.
So here's what we're going to do. So by the time this podcast goes out, what we won't have had the next podcast. We won't have recorded it. So what I want people to do is, when you hear this podcast, if you have a question or a comment, email it to us. And then we'll podcast, or we'll record the next podcast the day after this one drops. And so if you email us the day you know this one drops and you listen to it, we'll try to address your question the next day when we record the next podcast. And we'll continue on, because there's some other myths and misconceptions that we really should talk about. So we'll stick to the topic next week, and I think Curtis will be back and he can jump in on it as well. And then if you, the listeners, have some comments or questions, then send them to us and we'll address them as well. And that
at then nids@thinktoturns.com. That's nids@thinktoturns.com. It'll get to all of us.
Okay. All right. Well, so we'll continue on. We'll discuss exactly what you're talking about. You know, we've got a lot more to, we didn't even get into EMP effects, and
or zombies. We haven't talked about zombies.
Yeah. Will an EMP destroy all electrical equipment in the country? There's all kinds of stuff. So at any rate, so we'll go ahead and stop here. So thanks, Jim. That was a great discussion. Of course, thanks to you, the listeners. Make sure you're reading Global Security Review. There was a great article. There was a foreign affairs article that said that Pakistan is building an ICBM to coerce the United States. And well, what did we do on GSR? Well, we had a Pakistani author reach out to us who said, hey, that's a misreading of what Pakistan is doing. And so that author wrote an article that says Pakistan is not building a nuclear, an ICBM to put the U.S. at risk. And so there's lots of great stuff on Global Security Review, globalsecurityreview.com. You know, we've got HUSC events, so go to thinkdeterrence.com, look up the HUSC events. There's all kinds of great stuff going on, so please check us out. Follow us on LinkedIn. We post on all the new articles on Global Security Review on LinkedIn and at NIDS on LinkedIn. So check us out there.
And we have our NIDS Academy. If you want to learn about this stuff, I was just recording an EMP course that is the basics of EMP. If you don't know anything about EMP, take that course. You'll come right up to speed.
So, okay. All right. Well, it's been a great show. Thanks, everybody. And of course, we always want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.